birds, people, and the dogs that bring them together. This is episode number 8. My name is Bill, and you're tied to the Woe Post. I read somewhere that most podcasts fail prior to their 7th episode. And now that we're officially past episode number 7, I feel like we're that much closer to success. I want to thank everybody for listening and for all of your continued support. The best way to support the podcast is to share it with a friend. Or you can head on over to patreon.com/thewopost and become a patron. It's been an exciting week here at the Wopost Kennels. I finally finished up a renovation on a property that I've been working on since about October, and I'm finally ready to open up my Airbnb. Now I'll have a ton more time to spend on dogs and building the kennel. I think I'll be working a bit with Dave from Faith in the Point Bird Dogs. They're good people over there, and anytime you get the chance to work with a good pro trainer, you take it. Most of you already know you can find them on Instagram at fit_point_birddogs or at fit_point_kennels. Skeet and I are on day 4 or 5 now of Force Fetch, so we're introducing new fetching tools and starting to make her move to get the tool. It's going a little bit too easy though, and sometimes I wish the dog would resist a little because it's easier to see progress. We're going to keep it moving though, and might even pick up the pace a little bit, just make sure we don't get ahead of ourselves. And yesterday, we had our first training day of the season at our Navda chapter. Probably half of the handlers there were new to the chapter. It's always great to share the training field with new members and continue to spread and grow our culture. And you know I've got to talk about Embark, but I'm not going to take up too much of your time with that. But if you're a breeder, genetic testing should be a part of your program. Use the affiliate link in the description, go to their website, order your kit, and set up a breeder account. It's that simple. And the last thing before we really get started with the podcast, I promise, you can contact me, bill@thewopost.com, or on Facebook or Instagram, @thewopost. This week, we continue the Versatile Breed series with the English Pointer. Earliest records of the Pointer go back to the 1650s. They're the first dog known to locate and stand or point game. They were typically used for rabbits. The Pointer would point, and the hunter would send in hounds to track the rabbits. They were first trained as dedicated bird dogs in the 1700s. Known as the Aristocrat of Gun Dogs, they were imported to the U.S. in the 1860s and used by privileged sportsmen to hunt birds. They're friendly, intelligent dogs with a strong build and a high drive. They require regular physical and mental exercise, and it's said a tired pointer is a happy pointer. They're good members of a hunting household as long as owners set and enforce boundaries. Males should stand 25 to 28 inches tall and weigh approximately 55 to 75 pounds, while females would stand 23 to 26 inches tall and weigh approximately 45 to 65 pounds. However, balance and symmetry outweigh size. They have a short, dense, smooth coat, which can be colored liver, lemon, black, or orange. And of course, these are the long-tailed pointers. Discussing pointers with me today, I have Bob Cones. Bob and his wife Leona are the co-owners of Hackberry Kennels, along with their partners Brian and Shira Kennedy. Since 2009, Hackberry has been a well-known, longtime breeder of Ilhieu-influenced field trial champions and very competent hunting dogs. Hey, Bob, thanks for being here.
No problem.
Could you start out by maybe telling us a little bit about yourself?
I started hunting probably somewhere like a freshman in high school, I guess. I'd hunt on my dad's farm. He didn't really care for that. But I started hunting there. And then shortly after that, I met up with a friend that had a Vizsla hunting dog and went hunting with him a few times. And then finally, shortly after that, he asked me if I bought a female or if he bought a female and I would take care of it and whelp it and hunt it. And we breed to his dog and share the pups. And I said, that sounds like a good idea, because I had no output of cash. Well, his dog, when we tried to mate, it would never mate. And so eventually I bought Art out and found a non-registered dog, Vishla, and bred it to it. And we had a litter of pups, and that went okay. And shortly after that, then after I became a senior, I was immediately drafted and went to Southeast Asia for a little over a year and a half. And during that time, she somehow passed away. I don't remember exactly why or how, but I spent years then farming, some raising a family, and got into livestock nutrition. So as I got older and toward retirement, I wanted to do something a little different. So I decided I would buy a hunting dog. And so I bought a female. Actually, I bought two female litter mates. And they were like honky-tonk attitude breedings. That was okay. I had a litter of pups. But then I ended up buying a Elhew female pup. And I really, really liked her. And so I eventually just got another one. And I went out and spent a lot of money and got her sire. And her sire was called Flashpan. And they were so much easier, more biddable to train, that I eventually just eliminated all the honky-tonk stuff in my kennel. And then I went out and I purchased two female Elhew dogs. They were litter mates, Kate and Piper, mated both of them to my Flashpan dog, and that went really well. And by the time that was over, I had to expand on my facilities. And then I took Kate and I mated her surgically inserted semen to a dog called Black Ice. And he was a champion field trial dog. One of the pups out of that litter became a national champion. Two of the other males were NASTRA champions. And then that was kind of the start of a lot of it. The litter mate Piper, I then eventually made her surgically inserted semen to Elhew Jefferson, which was a real kick off for my kennel, because I got a popular dog by the name of Hackberry's Elhew Cody, and a litter mate female that was just as substantially positive for my kennel. Her name was Hackberry's Elhew Sydney. And they have been a real important part of my kennel. During that time of years, then I had to do another expansion. Then as I got a little older, I decided I'm going to try and make whelping a little easier and better for me. So I built another kennel, just a four-dog kennel that was what we call the whelping building. So now I have three buildings. We just kind of got started. And as I got older, I got a partner that had done a little bit of work with training. So he does a lot of the training and is now a full partner in the kennel. His name is Brian Kennedy. He and Sherry do that. My wife, Leona, does most of the bookwork for all the kennels and stuff. To go back maybe a little bit, in the beginning, when I started looking around to see what kind of breed I was going to breed, someone gave me a American Field magazine. And as I studied that magazine and looked at it in the open trials, 70% of the winners were English pointers. And I'm kind of the kind of likes to be the best. And so if you want to be the best, you got to breed the best. And that was kind of how I brought that up. So that's how I got into the English pointers and why I got into them.
So what do you think was the biggest trigger, the biggest thing that you learned over the course of 40 years between sort of a backyard Vishla litter and then a couple of backyard pointer litters to litters that ultimately ended up with dogs like Cody and Sydney?
Well, I think there are several reasons. You know, the traits that they had. You know, the Elihu pointers, in my opinion, were earlier developing dogs. They were easier to train. Plus, I like the looks of them. I like the large square face, you know, the definite stop between the eyes, the dish face, as you call it. You know, they're dogs that are, these Elihu dogs are generally pretty smooth in the shoulders and tight in the blades, you know, definite blade structure. You know, they have the front legs that I like to see that are straight, basically, with some separation between the legs. And by that, I mean the chest width of chest. The back legs, to me, have the proper angulation for a dog to run. And, you know, that keeps the structure well done. You know, when I look at dogs, I look at the gait, how they run. If a dog is running smooth and easy, they generally run longer and harder and are not as sore the next day. You know, so I like a nice flow in the run. And those are just the traits that I felt like I saw in the Elihu line when I got switched over to more of the Elihu dogs.
You know, I think you're the third very experienced breeder that I've spoken with now on the podcast. And every time I talk to a breeder, it's almost like we bring up structure unsolicited and how important that is for breeders. And I think a lot of hunters and maybe some trainers discount structure. They want a dog with drive, want a dog with drive that'll just go. What they don't think about all the time is what the breeders are doing behind the scenes is giving them a dog that's not only going to have the right drive and it's going to go, but it's going to go for 10 to 12 years.
Yes, yes. And structure, to me, has a huge amount to do with that. The thing that I probably do different than a lot of people is, as you've kind of heard, I use a lot of surgically inserted semen. I have went out, and anytime that I could find good dogs, the good dogs, I just bought it. I didn't argue with price. I just went out and bought it. And so I have accumulated a fair amount. I've been told I probably have as much as anybody in the country, but I don't know that for sure. I don't know what other people have. But I do have a lot of the old-time dogs. My philosophy on that is I want to go back and use those big-time dogs, like the Elihu Jeffersons, the Snakefoots, the Explorers, the Distinction, those kinds of dogs. And I'll use those in my breeding stock and grow them and be my breeding stock for the future. One of the things that I really look at is to make sure that when I'm looking at a pedigree, I'm not looking at a big name dog like a Jefferson or a Sport 5 or 6 generations back. I want it to be in the no further than a grandfather to most of my dogs. Bob Wiley had said himself that basically, you go much past 3 generations, you lose a lot. That's why I do that, I guess, is because it's important to me to look at a dog. Well, looking at a stud dog as an example, okay, I want to know that he is not just a champion quality dog, but a producer of champion quality dog. And to me, there's a huge difference between a champion dog or champion quality dog and a champion producer of dogs. And Bob Wiley would be one of the first ones to tell you that if he was still alive. And so we do use a lot of semen, frozen semen, for that purpose, to make sure that we're doing that. Too many times, I think there are good dogs out there, but they're dead before we know what kind of producer they are.
Mm.
You understand? You know,
yes.
By the time the dog produces himself, if he does breed right away, you know, because you want to make a good dog to breed, you know, and then for his offspring to be up and be a champion type dog, we didn't collect those dogs. I maintain that in my pedigrees, I have that champion dog, producer of champion, producer of champion, producer of champions. That's what I want to see in my cat and in my pedigrees. That's something that I feel like I do different. Like I said a little bit ago, Bob Wiley was one that I think he started LHU Kennels. Do you know what LHU Kennels, how that comes from?
I don't know.
Okay, Bob Wiley started LHU Kennels. That was his foundation, like in 1936. LHU is Wiley spelled backwards. And he started, I think it was like in 1936, he used a dog called Lexington Jack. And that was a dog that I think he got from England, if I recall right, if I have that right. But that goes back a little bit to like Hook's Bounty Hunter, which was the sire of Strike. Strike was Bob Wiley's, I think, first black dog, and also the sire of Snakefoot, which, you know, everybody's kind of heard of LHU Snakefoot. You know, they wrote books about him. In my kennel, you know, there are some things that are necessary for me. You know, if I'm going to keep a dog, whether it's a dam or a stud dog, they have to have a powerhouse nose. Like I talked about earlier, they have to have that close pedigree to the big name dogs. Being structurally correct is very important to me. And intelligence is something that is extremely important, because that's where I think the LHUs do have an advantage in. And then, like we talked about, the look, you know, I want the dished face in the dog. You know, I'm going to raise the dogs that I like to look at too. You know, and for the most part, I think the LHU line does kind of fit that category, I guess is the way I'd say it.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, so the looks are the last. And that's what I always tell people is you don't want to pick a dog that you don't find attractive. You don't want to pick an ugly dog. If you're talking about picking a puppy out of a litter, you want to pick a dog that you like to look at. But that should be the very last criteria that you consider, and all of those other criteria, and really the way you listed them out, are they, you know, that should be what you look at first.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of important to me, because if you look at dogs, generally speaking, that have a little wider nostril, generally they're going to have a little wider chest. With the wider chest comes some endurance with lung capacity. And then also, you know, they're generally a little heavier boned. I find that sometimes these smaller, finer bone dogs are a little, let's say, squirrelier to train, if you know what I mean. I think that the bigger, heavier bones are generally, there's nothing true with everything, but generally speaking, are easier to train.
Do you think that a wider chested or bigger chested dog cools itself a little bit easier too on the hot days?
Yeah, and I think that's a combination of, like we talked about a little bit, the gait too. You know, a smooth running dog can run longer and harder. It's easier for them to run, and so they run easier. You can take the best athlete in the world, put it on a tricycle, or have a freshman in high school with a 10-speed bike. You know, they're still going to win.
Right. Yep. Dog's got to have the right wheels.
That's not the right way to say it, but that's how I kind of relate to it. So,
no, I think that's a pretty good analogy. Besides that article in American Field, what is it that drove you to the English Pointer?
Basically, it was the amount of winners found in that. I would say that was probably this whole thing. And I kind of like the looks of them. A lot of other dogs, as you well know, have one color. You know, this was intriguing to me that the English Pointers have four different colors. Well, there's what they call black, liver, orange, and lemon.
Okay. I don't know that I've ever seen a black pointer.
They're all white and black, white and orange, white and liver, white.
Oh, okay. I got you.
I should have said that differently. They're more white than they are the other colors. But gotcha. They all have mostly white.
So the white's implied.
I apologize. I'm just used to saying black. Everybody knows they're white almost. So
right.
That's my fault.
For us, for the non-pointer people, you have to be more descriptive. That's all.
Okay. I see.
The small Munsterlander folks, we keep it pretty straightforward. We have dogs that are brown and white and dogs that are roan.
I see. And
that's it. But we talk about all the colors. We don't just assume that everybody knows that, oh yeah, they've got white on them too, but it's a brown dog.
Well, when my wife does the registration, she makes sure that they're white and orange or white.
Gotcha.
But yeah, there are no black dogs, I guess.
What do you think is important to you about the temperament with the pointers?
Personally, we have incorporated a program from Auburn University called the Superdog Program. And what that is early socialization of the puppy. In other words, when on day two of their life, day two of birth, each puppy is held in a hand for 5 seconds. It's turned upside down on a hand for 5 seconds. 1 foot each day, we take a Q-tip to go between each toe, and then it is set on a coal or ice rag for 5 seconds. So we do this for 3 weeks, every pup, every day. So each foot will have the opportunity to have 4 different times where you put the Q-tip between. The early socialization that we've done with the Auburn program has made a huge difference. And we can see it even in dogs that are adults. It starts out and helps a whole lot. We'll have puppies come up to us easier, and we don't have that pup don't have nearly as many pups that are what you call shy or that sort of thing. The All-Hugh line does have a little bit of history to be a little bit shy, but this kind of really, really does help them a lot. What I think it does is it gives more recognition and correlation between the trainer and the dog. And that relationship builds as you get older, even though it's passed on, the pup might be passed on to someone else. That relationship continues to build and makes a better transition for the puppy, makes a better transition for the owner, and it carries on for a long time. It was surprising to me how much it helped. This program, I believe, if I understand it right, was started in Auburn as by the police dogs and bomb sniffing dogs and the airport dogs. That's how it was started. And I've incorporated it in my kennel. And so now every dog, every pup gets that program the first 3 weeks of life.
Yeah, I've heard of the Superdog before. I think a lot of people have. I know a lot of reputable breeders incorporate that in their early puppy socialization. I did not know that it came from Auburn, though, and I also didn't know of its genesis with working dogs.
Yeah, it's my understanding that's where it got started. It
makes a lot of sense. I think the working dog, professional working dogs, whether it's law enforcement or military working dogs, the training and the research into the training is way ahead of where we are in the sporting dog world.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What are some of the strengths of the pointers?
I think the misunderstanding of English pointers is that they are very capable of being house dogs. I think they have a reputation for being wild and running hard and this, that, and the other thing. But I think that there's sort of a misunderstanding about that, and also how they can be trained. They kind of have a reputation for running out, and some do. But I think when you have the correlation and the training of the owner, sometimes the operator is a big part of how they react too. I personally don't like dogs that polish my boots when I'm hunting either. You know, there's a you know, some of that will go on. I just don't like a dog that does that. But, you know, a dog running at 15, 20 mile an hour through the field and then suddenly comes to a stop and the tail goes straight up when it finds a bird, that's a lot better than shooting the bird, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't think I would hunt birds if it wasn't for the dogs.
Yeah.
And seeing a dog snap into a hard point like that, it'll that's something to look at every time for sure. I want to rewind a little bit though, and you know, you mentioned there's a false perception that a field bred pointer can't be in the house, and you know, my opinion on that is that's just a product of bad breeding. If you're taking a dog, the highest drive stud dog, and breeding that dog to the highest drive, least biddable bitch, then those two temperaments are going to be, you know, genetically passed down to the next generation, and you're going to end up with puppies with incredible drive and poor biddability. And those aren't going to be nice dogs to have in the house. I think that's not good, responsible breeding.
Yeah.
They might be great trials dogs, but they're not going to live in your house.
Well, you know, what I've found with the LHE line more than the other lines is that they do have that on-off switch where, you know, when you get out the orange coat, if they're in the house, they can be calm. And when you get out the orange coat, they kind of change temperament if they want to go hunting. And the gun can do that. And I'll have customers tell me that too. It's unbelievable the number of people that have purchased a dog from me and have it in the house. A huge amount of that.
I've got both of my dogs in the house. They sleep in my office and their crates are right over here. They sleep here every night. They're usually in here when I'm working. Today's a bit different. We're going to have to get some more energy out of them later on tonight. But it's funny that you said, you know, putting on the orange and having the dog kind of snap to and know it's time to go to work, because as soon as I pull a shotgun out of the safe, my dogs both know that it's time to go have some fun. And we might just be going out to the training field, or we might actually be going to hunt, but they know what shotguns mean.
Okay. Yep.
So besides Cody and Sydney, what are some other notable dogs that have come out of Hackberry Kennel?
Well, we do, you know, some trialing and not, I wouldn't say a lot, but we do have like Patch. He was out of my Kate dog, L. Hugh Kate, an Explorer daughter, made it to the West Falls Black Ice, and he was a national champion. And he had two litter mates that were both national champions. So those were notable dogs, and I'll still use in my breeding program some of that. I like to send out dogs that are mostly LHU, but maybe 25 to even less percent possibly of something else. The Black Ice and the Rockick or Blackhawk has made it very, very well with the LHU line, in my opinion. And that's what that cross was. So that has worked very well for me, that type of cross. You know, in the LHU line, there's a lot of people that want to stick to 100% LHUs, and I still have that. I still have 100% LHU dogs. You know, the outcross or adding some heterosis into that line gives a little genetic kick, you know, and I think helps the dog with certain things that we're not too closely related. You know, there's just not a lot of LHU dogs that you can go and be outcrossed too much anymore. I'm just not one that likes to breed brother, sister, or father, daughter. So I'm not that. And I like to just outcross a little bit more for most people.
I think one thing that I've been told recently, I think it was on a podcast recently, was that if you're line breeding, about every third or fourth generation, you should look to breed outside of that line.
Yeah.
Is that about what you're looking at for what you do?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to create a new wheel here, because Bob Wiley, I think, had what I wanted and the way I like to breed dogs, the way I like to look at them. And that's kind of what he did to an extent too. I mean, every third, fourth generation, you know, he would go out. Now he did more line breeding than what I do. You know, there's a reason you don't marry your first cousin sometimes, you know, and that's just how I look at it.
Not in Iowa, anyway.
Yeah.
I hope not.
I hope that didn't come off wrong.
If you offended a listener there, that may have been a listener that we didn't need. I don't know.
sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
No, it's fine. Bob, if we're not having fun, then we shouldn't be doing this at all.
Okay.
What else do you think you'd like to tell us about your kennel?
The one thing that I would like to add, if it's okay, is that this fall, Ronnie and Suzanne Love Smith are going to do a seminar here at my kennel, October 19th and 20th, a foundation seminar. And I don't know if you know who they are, but...
Yeah, everyone knows who they are.
Okay. They're going to do a seminar here. And so we're getting ready for that and excited about that. That's going to be October 19th and 20th at my kennel.
Do you know if you still have available slots for that?
As of right now, we do, yeah.
I might look into that. Right around that time, I may have puppies dropping, but I'll know more as we get closer to that, and I might try and make it out to that.
Yeah, it'd be worth your time. They do a fantastic job.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Bob, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I appreciate you telling us about your kennel and everything. I'll give you a chance to wrap it up if you have one more thing you'd like to say.
I guess what I'd like to say is we try to take care of our customers. We enjoy seeing pictures and videos come back to us after we've sold a pup. I would probably like to say that, I am in Southwest Iowa, actually Shelby, Iowa, which is about 90 miles west of Des Moines and about 40 miles east of Omaha, Nebraska. Would love to hear from anybody else that would like to contact me.
And how can they get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me at 402-681-3046.
And your website is www.hackberrykennels.com?
Yes, it is.
And what's your email?
hackberrykennels@gmail.com.
All right, Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed episode number 8 of the WoPost podcast. If you're listening on Apple and you'd like to, go ahead and leave a 5-star review. It helps us with the algorithm. And if you have any recommendations, you can always contact me on Facebook or Instagram at the WoPost or email bill@thewopost.com. Please remember to share this podcast with your friends, and if you're so inclined, become a patron at patreon.com/thewopost. Stay steady, and God bless.